international travel remained current, CIA officers or assets were sent on probes to survey travel routes, observe immigration practices, collect chops in passports at foreign border crossings, and record changes in entrance-exit procedures in countries of operational interest. A few months before the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks, a CIA officer had his attaché case stolen in a European country while registered as a guest at an upscale hotel near a major airport. OTS had modified the attaché case by creating an inner cavity for secreting papers that documented the officer as a resident of a neighboring country. The attaché case came into possession of the local Internal Security Service, where the secret compartment and contents were discovered. The alias documentation was turned over to the country that had supposedly issued the documents, where an investigation determined the papers were forgeries. Suspecting that the origin of the forgery was the work of a third country, not the United States, the offended service registered a blunt objection. The third country's intelligence service knew it had no role in the fabrication, but to calm matters, simply acknowledged receipt of the materials without comment. Nearly a year later, at a conference of intelligence services cooperating on detecting terrorist forgeries, the story was related and the documents displayed. The OTS officers immediately recognized the documents as ones they fabricated. Later, a friendly colleague from a third country privately commented, "We know these aren't ours. They are really good, almost perfect, better than anything we could do. We don't know who else can do such fine work, but we thought you should know that the capability is out there." Obscured by the language of intelligence diplomacy was a professional compliment for OTS's fabrication skills. Alias travel documents were critical to the success of a CIA sting operation in the late 1980s. The CIA needed intelligence on the capabilities of a tactical missile being designed in a country hostile to the United States. Tight security surrounded the missile program, and foreign visitors were never given access to the facility where components were assembled. To attempt to gain access, a CIA agent assumed the persona of a Middle Eastern businessman and the cover of an international military equipment broker. The agent needed to find a way to get inside the building to photograph the equipment. CIA planners contrived a scenario whereby the agent acquired information that a third country, also hostile to the United States, had interest in secretly buying several of the missile systems. The intelligence, in the form of official appearing documents, had all been fabricated by OTS. The agent made contact with a representative from the target country for a confidential discussion and presented the so-called intelligence with a proposal that he broker the sale. Suspicion was high, but the asset's intelligence, cover story, and identification papers were so convincing that follow-up meetings were arranged. The asset demonstrated good faith by putting several $100,000 on the table, and serious negotiations about a possible sale began. He established the position of his client that any deal would be contingent on his inspecting the goods before signing a purchase contract. Over several weeks, discussions went back and forth until the target country's senior official called for a final meeting. The negotiations lasted 3 days, but eventually a verbal agreement was reached and formal papers drawn up for signature. The seller agreed to the asset's demand to inspect the production facility and missile components. Then, with the contract papers on the table ready for signature, the senior negotiator abruptly called a halt. "Let me see your passport," he demanded. The asset, stunned by the request, had no choice but to comply. The negotiator slowly examined the passport page by page before handing it back with a smile. "I just wanted to make sure," he explained, "that you were in Yemen in March 3 years ago, like you told me yesterday. I see you were. Now let us conclude our business." The tension subsided as the asset struggled to maintain his composure. In fact, he had never been in Yemen, although travel to that country had been built into his cover story. OTS had inserted the required visa into his passport, valid for the month in question. The text had properly dated the entry and exit immigration chops, complete with scrawled initials of the immigration officers. In fact, The entire passport, visa, entry-exit stamps, chops, and signatures had been constructed by OTS. A concealed camera in the asset's briefcase silently filmed the entire drama. Sometime later, a senior DO official called the operation one of the best of the decade. Its success hinged on the work of the OTS's document fabrication and authentication officers. From the cover perspective, CIA employees fall broadly into two classifications, overt and undercover. The majority of CIA employees are overt, acknowledge their CIA affiliation, and each January receive W-2 forms issued by the Central Intelligence Agency. Typical of overt employees are individuals in senior management positions, those with assignments in public affairs, the Center for Study of Intelligence, congressional liaison, personnel recruitment, analytical components of the Directorate of Intelligence, and research units in the Directorate of Science and Technology. These individuals perform work that does not require a covert identity. Within the Directorate of Operations, most employees have cover, as does any other agency officer who participates in covert operations. Cover documents provide corroborating personal and public material to establish and support the legitimacy of a cover and a fabricated identity. The CIA categorizes cover in two types, official and commercial. Official covers are provided by other government agencies and departments, while commercial covers are acquired from private sector companies or private individuals. The cover of any individual officer can be adapted to the operational need and ranges from light to deep. Officers may have a cover that allows them to work using their true name, or they may assume an alias as part of operational cover. Two types of aliases are frequently used. The most common is a created identity. Officers are assigned randomly selected names, consistent with their ethnic appearance, and supported by standard identification documents such as driver's license, credit cards, social security card, and passport. Throughout their career, officers would be issued multiple aliases and supporting documents. Since 1990, however, the created identity has become increasingly vulnerable to detection as an alias due to interconnected databases containing official and personal information about individuals. The adage, "If you don't exist in cyberspace, you are probably a fraud," has become a truism that limits the long-term operational use of created identities. Borrowed identities offer an alternative to fictitious identities, but require the cooperation and temporary disappearance of the voluntary and cooperating donor. Borrowed identities have the advantage of possessing a verifiable personal history and require no manufactured backstopping of the individual's college attendance, work history, social connections, or forged documents. The borrowed identity also exists as a cyber persona, since, at minimum, credit history shows up on numerous databases. Reproduction of personal ID papers is simplified by a willing donor making the material available to document specialists. OTS technicians can provide effective disguise in the form of the donor's clothing and, within reason, body appearance. Borrowed identity, normally reserved for particularly sensitive operations, was successfully employed to effect the single personal meeting that occurred between an agency officer and Trigon in Moscow in 1976. Disguise can either complement an alias or obscure the true identity of the user. The history of OTS's disguise work, like documents, began in OSS. At the formation of TSS, disguise became part of the Furnishings and Equipment Division, and subsequently supported covert operations by altering the appearance of officers and agents to protect their true identity or ensure against future visual recognition. Disguise also can make an individual's appearance consistent with photo identification documents that are used to support an alias identity. Disguise conceals personal identity as woodblocks conceal microphones and transmitters. CIA officers meeting with assets often have employed light disguise in conjunction with an alias. Such disguises may give the officer a visage that alters his true features. A light disguise might include a wig, glasses, mole, facial hair, dental appliance, or certain articles of clothing. Whether the disguise is realistic or believable is less important than the fact that it prevents the officer from being recognized later. Light disguises would typically be employed when meeting with an unknown volunteer who asks to speak to someone in intelligence. To avoid the risk of exposing an officer to someone who could be a terrorist or part of another intelligence service's dangle operation, the CIA representative would apply a light disguise before engaging the volunteer. Light disguises are also issued to members of surveillance teams to protect them from recognition by the target or by well-wishing friends whom they might inadvertently encounter while on the job. As necessary, more elaborate disguises, using full or partial facial masks, could perform an ethnic or sex change to alter a person's racial or gender appearance. Among the options are padded clothing to alter body type and weight distribution, sculpted appliances that alter eye color, mouth lines, and affect speech tone, makeup and hair coloring, hand and arm gloves to match facial coloring, shoe lifts to add height, and torso devices to create a stooped posture. Individually and in combination, the disguise techniques can affect dramatic appearance change. For officers in need of a disguise subject to close attention and durable for hours or days, OTS specialists would spend several hours performing the transformations. These labor-intensive disguises were typically applied on individuals in high-risk situations, such as illegal border crossings. Given time, the disguise specialists would alter hair color, apply facial hair, modify jaw lines, improvise dental work, create wrinkles, change complexion, or add glasses and warts to match any photographic documents and thus avoid chance recognition at a border crossing or airport checkpoint. The use of disguise to maintain secrecy is a basic means of acquiring information otherwise unavailable. It is also one of the most ancient. The Old Testament describes several disguise incidents in the history of the Hebrew people, such as Jacob's deception of his father Isaac to secure the family birthright. The Chinese strategist Sun Tzu offered instructions for disguising spies in The Art of War with this comment: "Your surviving spy must be a man of keen intellect, though in outward appearance a fool, of shabby exterior, but with a will of iron." More recently, Shakespeare was famously fond of disguises, incorporating them into his plays, including Twelfth Night, Measure for Measure, and As You Like It. The 21st century spy's disguise must not only be flawless in outward appearance, it must also reflect his assumed identity in the array of sophisticated documentation safeguards in use throughout the world. Disguise must match a digital persona that includes holographic images and microchips containing biometric data embedded into passports and travel documents. Personal information on the internet that is compatible with one's disguise becomes as critical to the modern spy's identity as the traditional counterfeit beard and eyeglasses. Chapter 22. Concealments. The OTS concealment specialist combines the skills of a craftsman, the creativity of an artist, and the illusion of a magician. An OTS concealment engineer. In 1586, secret correspondence to Mary Queen of Scots from the French ambassador was concealed inside barrels of beer and smuggled to her at the country estate of Chartley, England, where she was under house arrest. During the American Revolution, couriers who traveled by boat carried intelligence reports inside weighted bottles that could be dropped overboard at the threat of capture. A hollowed-out lead bullet was used to conceal smaller written messages, but this was eventually replaced by a similar bullet made of silver that could be swallowed at the first sign of danger without incurring the ills of lead poisoning. OTS's laboratory for concealments grew out of the OSS Research and Development Camouflage Division in Fort Washington, Maryland, which had produced letter drops for use by World War II agents. The drops were originally made from tree limbs. The wood was split, and a metal container inserted in such a fashion that the wood could be replaced and present an innocent appearance to any observer. An important principle learned after receiving comments back from the field was that the drops should never be constructed of anything burnable or edible, lest they be picked up and used by some passerby needing food or fuel. Afterward, better drops were produced in various forms that included stones and old tin cans. Such drops were designed to be ignored by anyone not involved with the operation and could be left at public locations, such as at a prearranged distance from a mile marker on a European road, for a two-way exchange of intelligence. Another research and development unit, Division 19, Miscellaneous Weapons of the National Defense Research Committee, supported OSS's wartime requirements and established its first lab in June 1943 at the Congressional Country Club outside Washington, D.C., operating as the Maryland Research Laboratory. Under the project codenamed MOTH, three containers were created for transporting concealed secret intelligence documents with devices to destroy the contents if opened by a person unfamiliar with its use. One device could be camouflaged inside a fountain pen or shaving kit and held two or three folded sheets that would be destroyed 30 seconds after initiation. The second was a medium-sized notebook with bound sheets that was destroyed summarily, and the third was a briefcase capable of destroying a special insertable pocket for maps and papers. The U.S. Army operated a secret Escape and Evasion, E&E, laboratory and facility under the secret MISX program at Fort Hunt, Virginia, during World War II. This lab produced concealments and E&E aids, including silk maps hidden in clothing and playing cards, compasses inside uniform buttons, safety razors, pencils, and fountain pens, and shortwave radios inside mess kits, baseballs, and cribbage boards. The true nature of the CIA's original concealment program, a charter function of the technical services staff, was obscured by its name, Furnishings and Equipment Division. During the Cold War, objects with unapparent cavities, such as furniture and automobiles, were required when it became operationally desirable to hide a person, passageway, or object. Concealment created the illusion that the object being used for hiding had no relationship to a clandestine operation. Camouflage was a less secure means of hiding than concealment. Like a cover, if camouflage is removed, the contents could be seen. A large safe with a tarp thrown on top may be camouflaged, and removing the tarp would expose the object as a safe. However, if a false bottom was created inside the safe and the cavity door could be opened only by manipulating a hidden latch, the safe was transformed into a concealment. A concealment device, or CD, includes a hidden compartment to which access is obtained by mechanical decipherment of locks, hinges, and latches. The mechanical actions necessary to open a CD are normally a sequence of unnatural twists, turns, and pulls. Intelligence services used CDs to mask the entrance to tunnels or hiding places, as well as for hiding spy gear. OTS categorized concealments as being active or passive. An active CD possessed an obvious function that remained operable in addition to the internal cavity and the spy gear it housed. An example of an active CD was a fountain pen that wrote normally but contained a sub-miniature camera that could be operated without affecting the writing function. The writing instrument masked the presence of the concealment. Another example would be a video camera concealed inside a lamp, with both devices performing their designed functions separately or simultaneously. A calculator modified with a concealment cavity for a beacon was considered active if it continued to add, subtract, multiply, and divide. A passive CD provides a cavity for concealing materials, but does not perform another function to mask its clandestine use. For example, a wooden statue with a cavity in the base would have no function other than for display. An attaché case with a false bottom at its base, or a book with a hollowed-out cover, were other examples of passive CDs that became a standard part of every case officer's and agent's operational equipment. Concealments served five operational purposes: storing, bookcase at home; transporting, travel purse; exchanging, a loaded dirty mitten at a dead drop site; infiltrating, an audio transmitter inside a gift to a target; and masking, a wine rack placed in front of the entrance to a secret passageway. Spies with compromising equipment must secretly store and protect the clandestine gear in their possession. One-time pads for enciphering messages or sub-miniature cameras must be stored indefinitely for use at the appropriate time. Sensitive intelligence information or documents must be hidden until passed to the handler. CDs need to provide quick access to the equipment and information while protecting against accidental discovery by a family member or exposure during a more threatening security search. The size of the items to be stored in the concealment and the available method for getting the CD to the agent dictated what could be used. Virtually any object that offers sufficient volume can be converted into a concealment device, but the object has to fit into the user's lifestyle. The local economy in the agent's country often restricts the variety of CDs issued. In areas where consumer goods are in short supply, it may be difficult to find items that could be given to the agent for storage purposes without causing neighbors to be envious and suspicious. Constructing a CD inside a false-bottomed 5-liter petrol can be an effective storage device for an agent with a car or garage, but if the country was experiencing severe petrol shortages, such a luxury might be seen as out of place or be a target for theft. In the decades before data could be stored on disks and thumb drives, wooden desks and bookcases that could conceal a 4-inch briefcase, a large document, disguise items, radios, and cameras were among the most popular concealment hosts. Concealment furniture was constructed to blend in with the home decor of the user. Bookcases, in particular, were universally accepted as common furniture. They were durable and could be built with cavities throughout, at the top behind the molding, inside the shelves, in a false back, in the thickness of the sides, or with the largest cavity beneath the bottom shelf behind the skirt. Material being exchanged by dead drop was hidden inside specially constructed CDs designed to blend in with the site's surroundings and remain unrecognized until retrieved. If the drop site was in a park, a small piece of tree limb hollowed out to hold film cassettes or a false passport would have been a typical concealment. Waterproof containers, weighted with lead shot to compensate for the buoyancy, were constructed to fit inside drain pipes, toilet reservoirs, or submerged in the shallow water of a decorative pond or stream. Other natural environment concealments resembled bricks or chunks of masonry. These items were collectively known within CIA as sticks and bricks because, when deployed, they were indistinguishable from the original pieces in their natural environment. Dead drop concealments normally must have no value to the society where used. Otherwise, the concealment may be collected for its assumed worth. In theory, the more repulsive a dead drop CD appeared, the more attractive its operational use. A crushed can still dripping oil, a piece of electrical cable coming out a wall with exposed wires that appeared live, discarded bandages and medical waste, or animal excrement were unlikely to be picked up by a casual passerby. Animal carcasses, especially decaying ones, are universally offensive and thus effective for dead drop containers. OTS specialists periodically produced CDs from pigeons, rats, and an occasional roadkill. The lab animals were humanely killed, then gutted and treated to create an artificial cavity inside the stomach and chest. Some were freeze-dried and vacuum-packed in tin cans. Material intended for the agent was wrapped in aluminum foil and inserted inside the created cavity and the animal stitched back together. Before the carcass was deployed, it might be doused in Tabasco sauce as a deterrent to hungry cats roaming the streets. Pigeon carcasses were typically dropped at sites around parks, and the special rats were often just left by the side of the road. To make the dead rats even more repugnant, OTS constructed rubberized gut parts to spill out of the carcass as it lay on the road. When deployed, the roadkill CD was intended to be retrieved quickly. Agents needed a secure means to transport their spy gear. If recruited outside a denied area, the agent would be required to re-establish contact after they returned home and were ready to begin work. the techs found a solution by hiding one-time pads and commo schedules inside inexpensive tourist souvenirs such as statues of saints, reproductions of sculpture, and castings of famous buildings. These items could be collected in cities where the agent traveled, carried by hand, and readily explained as a tourist purchase if questioned. Low-cost items were less likely to be examined when packed in personal luggage. For greater security, these were one-time-use CDs that could not be opened without being broken to access their contents. Because there was no hidden latch or manipulation that might betray the method of opening the CD, the cavity was not likely to be detected, even during a close examination. People, as well as information, often needed to be transported. During the Cold War, CIA and OTS worked successfully on more than 140 illegal movement operations without ever losing a person. OTS constructed life-supporting human concealments for defectors or escapees in the form of specially designed exfiltration crates or modified automobiles. Refrigerator boxes could house an 8-hour life support system for a person weighing up to 250 pounds and measuring up to 6 foot 6 inches tall. The less than luxurious container included items needed to support basic life and body functionality, such as piddle packs for urination, absorbent sponges, food, water, ice packs, gel packs, a warming source, and circulating battery fans. Constraints on the internal oxygen supply usually limited the time a system could be employed. During one exfiltration of an agent from a Soviet bloc country, the border crossing took much longer than planned when the vehicle was held up at several checkpoints. The agent was wedged inside a concealment built in the car's trunk with virtually no room to move. Officers driving the car, although concerned about the agent's well-being, could do nothing. Finally, after several hours longer than expected, the automobile arrived at a safe location, the concealment opened, and the individual pulled out. To the amazement of the officers present, the agent was smiling and seemed unperturbed by his claustrophobic adventure. When asked how he had tolerated the experience so well, the safe and grateful agent replied that he had been a tank driver in the Soviet Army. As a result, he was accustomed to being a contortionist. In a less successful operation, OTS received a requirement for a Mercedes sedan configured to conceal a man who would be driven out of Eastern Europe. The lead OTS specialist designed a concealment using space created by reducing the car's fuel tank. He worked on the project for 6 months to remove the original tank, replace it with a smaller one, and make other external and interior configurations to accommodate the agent. When finished, the passenger area, trunk, and underside looked factory new. The tech received unanimous acclaim for doing a first-class concealment job. The automobile purchase had been disassociated from the agency, and the title and paperwork showed no official connection between the car and the U.S. government. The station arranged for a driver who was not aware of the intended use of the car to deliver the vehicle to Berlin. Apparently, the driver failed to heed the fuel indicator and ran out of gas while en route. He contacted the nearest Mercedes dealer because something wasn't working right. The tank had been full when he started the trip, yet the fuel gauge had fallen quickly, and he had run out of fuel well under the normal range for the vehicle. The technician examined the car for some time and then called the driver. "Sir, you have a problem," asserted the technician as he pointed out the small tank and the cavity. The discovery immediately ended the operation, but the U.S. government now owned a new limited-range Mercedes. Eventually, the car became the VIP touring sedan at one of OTS's covert facilities. Another exfiltration operation required a person be moved from a major hotel in a Middle Eastern country that was known to be under surveillance by the local service hostile to the United States. OTS techs covertly observed the comings and goings at the hotel for several days and determined that the surveillance focused exclusively on people entering and leaving, but showed no interest in baggage or luggage. It was, a tech suggested, time to consult with some of OTS's Hollywood contacts who specialized in performing magic tricks. If a magician could saw his beautiful assistant in half and then have her emerge intact from a coffin half a stage away, surely he could sneak some